Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started with the facilitated discussion session of today. Did you guys get a chance to go over the brief question sheet that we passed out during lunch? About 10 or 12 questions. You had a chance to look over it, get your thoughts together. Well, I'd like to start with an introduction. My name is Damian Alderman. I'm a research coordinator here at the University of Florida. I work at with the Department of Health Outcomes and Policy. And
hi, my name is Q Crawford. I'm one of the citizen scientists with the program, with the Clinical Translational Science Institute. Pretty much, I am on a board to be the layman's voice for the community. So pretty much in community engagement is what I do there.
And that's actually the focus of this session right here. We need to get more community engagement involved in clinical trials. The objective here, like Dr. Kogel said before, was to educate him about things that matter when it comes to community and research. And that's why it's important to have these discussions. As you can see, there was about 10 or 12 questions, and what we hope to gain from this are your insights onto the answers to these questions. I like to always start and say that there's no right or wrong answers. All opinions matter, and please take the time to share and let us know what your thoughts are. So we want to start with the very first question about how long have you had or someone that you know and love have had MDS? Anyone? Raise your hand. Oh, go ahead.
10 years.
10 years?
6 years.
16?
Six years.
Oh, 6 years?
20.
20.
20. And you, David?
2 years.
Two?
One.
Okay. Any other takers? Anyone else want to share? Oh, please.
2003.
Since 2003 and then five?
20.
One. A wide variety of ranges.
8 months.
8 months. So it ranges
eight
from.
Months. Wow.
So I'm hearing it ranges from 8 months to 13. Was it 13?
20
years. Wow.
Okay.
And that's just a general flow of how it's going to go this afternoon. I just like to have a question, announce it, and if I can, if I miss you, please. It's important that you stop me, because we, like I said before, we want to get everyone's voice heard. So we're going to go ahead and move along. We're going to start with the introduction that we just did. Our next topic is going to be about understanding MDS. We're going to move on to genetics and gene mutation reports. We're going to move to insurance and payment, technology and treatment, and last, and one of the more important topics, the future of research and outcomes that matter to you guys. So first and foremost, let's start with understanding MDS.
Okay. The next question would be, where would you say you get the most information about your MDS, whether that's on the internet, for example, but where do you get your information?
Internet. MDS Foundation.
MDS Foundation, and you said the internet?
Okay.
Foundation.
Okay, we're going to use the one mic, so if one person can speak and then the next person, we'll be able to hear everyone. So, Thomas, go ahead.
Yeah, internet, definitely.
Okay.
Are there any particular sites on the internet?
I look up a lot of clinical trials and things like that.
Have you found any ones that have been particularly interesting?
Nothing that jumps out, no.
Right.
The other thing that's informative is I found a good chat board of support group for strictly with my type of MDS.
That's also, in a lot of cases, online resources are very helpful, and support groups are one of the top lines of help. Any other? Yes, ma'am?
I've learned a great deal from watching the webinars that AAMDS puts on their website. You can actually pick whether it's aplastic anemia, MDS, because it relates to all of us, or PNH.
That's
and,
kind of amazing.
They have experts from all over the country just giving information.
Do you know about how often they host those webinars?
I think they're quite frequently. I mean, like every couple of months. And then what they do, you can do it live if you happen to be home and want to sit there for a couple of hours. I find that rather difficult. So they archive these things.
Okay.
And then you can go back onto their website, just go into MDS and look at whatever topics they have there. And
and what was that acronym, AAMD?
AAMDS. And they just included PNH with their group now, PNH Foundation also. So I think they're going to add something on the end of that.
Okay.
Does anyone else have online? Yes.
I've gone on Amazon and purchased about four textbooks. on blood disorders in general, a couple on AMDS, or on MDS, and they're kind of pricey for one thing, and that's a disadvantage. And they are pretty high level, but if you read them repeatedly, I think most of my books I've read probably at least 10 or 15 times, and every time I pick up something new, and I've asked some of the staff at Chan's to explain something, and they're always happy to explain. So even though it is high level, you will pick up a lot out of the textbooks. And to me, the what I've learned, it was well worth what I paid for them. And some of them are, you know, I haven't paid over $100 for any of the books. Now, that's not saying there aren't any out there over $100.
Right. Yeah.
But the ones I've bought, I tried to keep under $100. And I've learned a lot of them. My doctor saw me reading one, and he says there's going to be a quiz on that Friday. he understands some, you know, and he's glad to explain anything in there that I don't happen to understand.
I'm going along the lines of textbooks. Do you have a particular recommendation?
There's a one, and I can't think of the exact title, but it's a manual for stem cell transplantation. If you Google, or if you go on Amazon and look up manual for stem cell transplantation, it goes through, you know, the pretreatment care, the actual transplantation, what to expect in acute GVHD and chronic GVHD. It is very, very comprehensive, and it wasn't one of the more really expensive ones.
Okay.
That's great. Sometimes doing your own personal research does pay off. And it seems like it did in that case, for sure.
And I'm retired, so I got all the time.
anyone else have any resources they'd like to share?
Excuse me.
Oh, yes? I'm sorry.
If anybody has any of the blogs or forums that they like, could you get
the resources?
A lot of the ones that I've gone to... they're just so removed from what I'm experiencing that I can't seem to get a grasp on
some of the language into it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does anyone have any other blogs or resources?
Merrill Forms.
Merrill Forms?
Merrill Forms.
I've been to Merrill Forms. That's the one that I felt like I wasn't under. They were using a lot of abbreviations, and I just couldn't.
Okay.
Understand what they're trying to say.
We're kind of new at this, so a lot of this.
Right.
So when they use an abbreviation like BX, I understand what that is, but some of the things that they try to say what they've been through, and it's all RBT. And
right.
And I'm lost.
Right.
I wish there was a glossary.
Right.
Can I just? I don't need to interrupt, but in your packets today is a glossary that we
have. Oh, there we go. All right.
I hope you use it. It's very user friendly. I hope that helps.
That might help.
Some of that I'm finding is in the generation now of texting, like shortening everything.
Yeah.
That's what I'm seeing is messing that up.
Yeah.
Abbreviations.
I know. And so it could be something as simple as without, but.
Yeah.
Right. If you've never seen it shorthand, it's good luck deciphering it. Yeah.
Sweet.
Any other resources? Perfect. Next, we'd like to know... Oh, I'm sorry. Did someone... Oh, I apologize. How would you explain what gene mutation means with respect to your disease? It's a tough question. Well, no, this is our chance to educate him, so no calling on him for help. It is a really tough question to answer, but I guess basically, how well do you feel that you understand what gene mutation is?
Not enough.
It's new. Yeah. Well, especially in, like you're saying, if your situation's new, it's a heavy concept to wrap your head around.
The internet, the more I've gone into it, it's very confusing, but what comes out of it is that is the direction where they're finally going to come up with something that can help people permanently besides a bone marrow transplant.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
the more you read on it, the more smarter you get about it and understand it.
Knowledge is power.
It's like reading the books. You have to listen to it a gazillion times before it all sinks in.
Yeah, true.
Sometimes repetition is the only way to mastery.
If
anyone
you get
else?
The report from Dr. Kogel's eye care study, you know, if you're involved in that clinical trial, if you get the report from that, it'll tell you what gene mutations you have. And it doesn't specifically tell you what gene that does, but then you can take those genes that you've got mutated and go research them on the internet, and you probably learn more than you wanted to know.
Okay.
Well, actually, is a great segue to the next question I had is how well do you trust that your doctor knows all the gene mutations involved?
Yeah.
Pretty well.
Go ahead. You were saying something?
Our doctor tells us that he doesn't know enough to go back to Mont. that tells you right there how sure you are.
Yeah. I feel confident because, again, I'm being treated at Moffitt, my doctor's list, who's the head of the whole place.
And so that's actually, in preparation for this, Dr. Kogel gave me a very interesting fact, is that there are, and correct me if I get this wrong, but between 200 and 1,000 different gene mutations. So that's a lot. That's a lot to wrap your head around. Next segue I would like to go to, or next question, is about how much time do you think that your doctor spends looking up specifically your gene mutation? Do you feel like it's enough time?
Anyone?
All around yeses, nods?
I don't think they have enough time to do that. You know, if they've got more than 20 patients, they don't have enough time to spend on every patient. It's unfortunate, but it's... back to life. They got a limited amount of time. They got 24 hours in their day, just like we do.
Like you said, time's a commodity that we all desperately need more of when it comes to things. And researching up to 1,000 different mutations, it's a large task to ask.
And another question to think about that is, if any one of you have had your report with your doctor discussed, and how is that experience for you? Has anyone had that experience in their doctor's office or physician?
You mean going over the gene?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had that.
You've had it?
Yeah,
okay.
I got a full report and sat down with them. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
So what are your thoughts then about genetic testing? Great. Enjoy positive
promising.
Things. Promising.
I know it's forthcoming before too long, and now I'm even more interested in having it done.
Yeah. That is a push for the future. There's a lot more people looking to get their genes mapped out, so to speak.
How is that done? Is that just with a blood test?
Oh, that's a question for Dr. Kogel. Oh, he gives a thumbs up. Looks like it's a blood test. So I guess for those who have not had their gene mutation map, do you have any concerns or any thoughts about that, or anything preventing you in particular?
We're kind of back to that glossary thing.
Oh.
There's just so much technical and scientific data there that for the layperson, that's a whole nother section of research.
It really is. And again, getting back to how huge of a concept it is to kind of wrap your head around mapping or getting your full gene mutation. I can't. It's a lot to try to understand, especially like you're saying, without assistance. Like you need that that extra glossary.
Right. Any other suggestions? Okay, David?
If
I got it right.
Comment. I think there's a distinction between just having your genes, gene mutations tested in Dr. Kogel's eye care study, because he goes through just a massive amount of gene mutations, and they detect for those. Where I went to Moffitt, and they looked for very specific ones, one of them being ASXL1, and they found that one and several other ones. But they don't go through this whole entire spectrum like Dr. Kogel does. And I think it's a matter of cost. To do what Dr. Kogel's doing on this eye care study would be cost prohibitive for every center to be doing. And I wish Dr. Kogel was here to either cut.
He's in the back there.
Is that not true, that you go through the whole spectrum where Moffitt may go through a subset that's known to be problematic?
That's true. The cost is plummeting, and it'll soon be inexpensive. And so that's why we were asking the questions that we are, minus the cost, because there's going to come a point where the physician's going to have all of this genetic information, and we want to hear from you on how would you like that delivered to you.
Well, in my experience, because I've been dealing with treating cancer since 2007, is certain doctors have a certain regime of meds that they like to do, and they stick to those regime until you start having complications. And then they start focusing on maybe looking at other areas after they have exhausted this certain limit, which I would like to see more and more doctors thinking on a broader scale, like from what I'm hearing you do, instead of just sticking to a normal regime, as I call it, the rut syndrome. So that's my experience.
Protocols can be good and restrictive.
Yes, that's very accurate.
Can I ask, Doctor, that a full gene study, how much does Medicare cover that?
That's a complex question, because the full gene study that we're doing here at the university, I have cobbled together various sources to pay for that so that it's essentially free to the patients. And then, for example, I've gotten DNA companies who want to test out their product to commit to giving the reagents for free. So it's a lot about business deals as it is about science. I will tell you that Medicare does pay 80% of a gene profile panel. 20% has to be covered by either your second insurance plan or out of pocket.
Yeah, because going back to Moffitt, they didn't do a complete. In fact, mine, they did 53 mutations.
Did you have a comment? I thought I saw. Any other questions or concerns you want to voice about getting your gene mutation report?
Maybe on the heels of that, another thing that would be helpful is, to the extent that it's possible, sharing with patients what information is known about how it can be paid for, depending upon where you are with insurance, whether you're Medicare eligible or not, or what. Or I know that can't be across the board done for everybody, but just to give them some sort of general idea, and maybe then it would help them know who to go talk to, who to go ask, or whatever.
Right. Okay.
Go ahead, this may be a question for the doctor. Not putting you down on it, but
No. Go right ahead.
Okay. When you get a bone marrow biopsy, it's checked to see, where you stand and what you've got. How many genes do they check?
So,
I didn't even know anything about the gene until we got in here, and I say, gosh, I got one here I didn't even know about. Did they stop when they found out, or did they check for everything when they do the bone marrow study? What
are
you
talking
about?
I do. When they do a bone marrow biopsy, there are about 50 tests they can send it for. And each physician sends for their own group of tests. So it's hard to know, unless we look at each patient, what their test was sent for. But for genetic testing, it turns out that we can catch the gene mutations in the blood. We don't have to do bone marrow anymore. And if that doesn't answer your question afterwards, I'd be happy to answer more. But can I ask maybe to dive down on one of the questions?
Yeah.
If people can let us know approximately how much time has your doctor spent with you describing the genetic mutations of your chromosomes?
Mm. That's an excellent question.
I didn't even know it existed until we started talking here. I hadn't looked at this report.
Oh,
I got
a lot of,
said, well,
a lot of zeros.
I didn't know that, so they didn't talk about it at all.
Nor did the doctor
so,
at Lamb, nor did the specialist at him.
So the question was about how much time does your doctor spend sort of going over explaining the genetic report with you? All around, not enough time, zeros, and nothing.
Very little.
Very little, not enough. Oh, yeah.
What
right. What exactly does not enough mean? Has it been
5, 10?
Yeah, 5 minutes? 5 to 10 minutes.
I mean, you only get 15 minutes with the guy.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is just, you know, chit-chatting back and forth as far as getting in all these numbers and
yeah.
stuff like that. Very little.
And at one time I was told I had a mutation, IDH1, but then on my next biopsy, that seemed to have disappeared. So I don't know if somebody else read the report and just didn't pick up on that. I don't know where that stands.
Yeah, it seems like for a report of that size, you probably would need a little bit more than the 5 to 10 minute time.
Go
right ahead.
Would anybody be open to having a PhD or molecular oncologist to meet with you at the same time that you're in clinic to describe the gene mutations?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So again, the question was, would you be interested in having a PhD, or you said a molecular
oncologist
in the clinic to go over the gene mutation report with you? Yes? Yeses?
Yes.
That's good to know.
Can you hear back there? Just wanted to make sure.
I'm sorry, can everyone hear me okay? I have a tendency to talk pretty low when I start talking.
Okay.
Thank you. I guess next is for people who have seen their gene mutation report. We kind of discussed this briefly, but it seems like there are plenty of parts that are really tough to understand. What were your initial thoughts going through as you were reading it?
I can't say that next time. It's scary. You know, just the sheer quantity of gene mutations was scary.
Scary. Yeah, like just the sheer size of the report probably, like you were saying, is intimidating a bit to still read it.
Yeah. I was wanting to know more than they were just focusing on two of them. They weren't. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to discuss all five of them, and I wanted to know facts on all of it. So that was my thing. I don't want to just know. Okay, the two things that are causing my MDS. I want to know what the other genetic chromosomes. deformities are too, you know, and whether or not they'll cause me problems in the future.
Mm. So it all comes back again to that issue of time and there never being enough.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe a grade or assign a level of severity to each anomaly or issue. And, you know, that can alleviate some concern. You know, a 5q deletion versus, something that, you know, makes your toenails a different color. You know, who cares?
Well, that makes a lot of sense because it's if that was the case, it'd be really easy to see, like, okay, this has a high-level priority, low-level. This is like a C-graded concern or this is an A-level concern. I should really look into this. That makes a lot of sense. You can take a report that is initially intimidating and make it really easy to see which parts you need to really focus and pare down on. That's a great suggestion. I want to go to the next topic is how would you like to receive the information about your gene mutations? Be that directly in a doctor's office, email, phone call. How would you best like to receive that information?
Something written.
Something written.
I think a combination.
Yeah.
Doctor talking to you, and here's the
right.
All of the above.
Here's your report presented by the doctor.
Yeah.
You know, here it is. Now, read it and ask questions next time we see each other.
That's the key thing right there, because you go home and you read the report, and then you got all kinds of questions you didn't know to even ask.
Or they didn't discuss things that were in your report.
All right.
Yeah, that's...
I can see the report 2 weeks before I see the doctor.
Yeah.
Yes. Even my biopsies. I want to read my biopsy before I see him.
So getting the report and then follow up in a relative, almost like a relative short period of time, just to address concerns only about the report. That seems like a pretty good, it's a pretty good suggestion. Another important question about the gene mutation report: let's say your doctor finds something that's unrelated to your cancer. He finds information about Parkinson's disease or maybe breast cancer. Would you be interested in having your doctor tell you that information?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeses.
My personal feeling about that is that should be a question that is not across the board. That should be asked to
on an individual
patient, because I know a lot of folks who would rather not know that.
Got it.
You know, that's, if it's related to something else, especially depending upon what it is.
So it seems like individually, if as that is being done, they should ask that person right then and there, before the test is even done, perhaps. Say, if we find anything else, would you like us to let you know? And how would you like your doctor to sort of relay that information to you? Probably just, again, face-to-face, in person, like that? Yes. Sounds great. Next, we're going to move to a different topic. So we just heard that genetic testing can be relatively expensive. I think we found out that Medicaid or Medicare pays for 80%. How much would you be willing to pay out of pocket for the remaining 20? You would? How much would you be willing to?
Billing was $28,000.
$28,000 was your last billing?
Yeah. That's what they billed. That's not what they got. But
yeah.
That was out of pocket?
Well, that's what Moffitt billed Blue Cross.
Oh, okay.
Mm. So they probably got six or eight.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. So our next topic is going to be more about the technology involved in treatment. How do you feel about your doctor using a computer program to sort of design a treatment plan?
Back there?
Mm-hmm. I would say...
seems like what we do now.
Is what you do now?
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate more on that?
I'm not the person that's at the doctor's office, but doing what I do, that's... everything's guided by that.
Sort of putting in, symptoms and inputs and just seeing what the computer spits back out?
At least give a guideline for what the doctor needs to be looking at. I mean, if you depended on your doctor to know everything, you're going to have a problem, I would think. Mm-hmm. They got to have some guidelines. And the fellow over there had four books that were over $100. The doc can't know every single word in every single book. So anything that can help would be a good thing.
Okay. Anyone else?
I think you had something to say, ma'am. Here? Yeah. No?
I think as long as it's in conjunction with your doctor's knowledge, and I think it would be the same, because I think there is, I agree, you know, there's just so much information out there. As long as it's programmed properly, that's another issue.
John?
I think as medicine evolves, and it has drastically in just the last 5 or 10 years, really what computers are now doing is data mining and data collection, which helps, you know, in the research and the documentation of diseases, as long as it doesn't eliminate completely a personal and hands-on experience.
Right.
I mean, we've had some very bad experiences with computer medicine in the hospital because the protocols were so rigid that they didn't allow for
flexibility.
If you don't put it in the computer doesn't give you the result.
Okay.
And there were some near disastrous results because they weren't following the protocols of using the computer, and there were some drug interactions that were near life-threatening.
Okay. So that poses the next question, how safe do you feel that it would be accurate for you? Or
if they had gone to the computer first and pulled it up, I would not have had the issues that I had. But because they reacted versus researching, I had issues.
Okay.
It came down to the internist in the ICU really didn't know that much about chemotherapy and was actually gave drugs that were severe contraindicated with her drugs.
Right. So the data being pretty much accurate to the patient.
That's maybe a little off from what the original discussion was about, but computers are great, but there still has to be, you know, I was in medicine 25 years ago, and it was all hands-on. We didn't have computers back then to, you know, to diagnose and tell us what to do.
Right.
I think they're very useful, but there has to be a
tool.
It's a tool. It's another tool in the toolbox.
Right.
Just don't become so reliant on it that you forget how to touch a patient.
Yes. Flexibility.
I was just going to follow up and say it should just be a tool for the doctor who uses that, but then there's got to be a lot of common sense from the doctor based on his experience. If a doctor just takes something off a computer, I'd go find another doctor.
There's a very old saying with computers, and I'll probably be showing my age here, it's garbage in, garbage out. if you don't program your computer right, you can put all the data in the world and it'll spit out your dead. And, you know, if the doctor's got faith in the computer and the program and it's been validated, you know, I'm all for it. But there's got to be a common sense factor in there, and the doctor saying, you know, looking at it saying, this doesn't make sense. There's still got to be a human element in right now. Someday we may get to the point where, you know, the doctor spits out, you know, call time of death, and they do it. But right now, I think you still need the doctor standing by saying, no, this doesn't make sense.
You bring up a really good point about, validation. About, I guess, what would make you feel that this computer or algorithm has been properly, I guess, validated? I guess, how many doctors would it have gone through? To you, what does that validation mean?
Is the ultimate outcome better than the alternative? You know, what measurability?
Any other comments, questions? So one thing that was definitely common throughout everyone talking about this is that there still has to be a human component to all this. No one is comfortable with just letting a computer sort of spit out a diagnosis or prescription on its own without at least having been seen by your doctor just to confirm and make sure everything is right.
One of the good reasons for having a human component is last year in California where the computers were hijacked and nobody was able to access their patient charts. That's why you need to have a human component in knowing your history. Because we don't know. There's too many hackers out there.
Well, it's kind of scary at how much the healthcare sector is affected by malware. The public really isn't made aware of because it's scary. Down to hijacking the IV pumps.
So that's a concern.
Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, is there anywhere else you would like to see technology kind of contribute in further? No one in particular?
More accurate survival charts.
So next we want to move on to a little bit more about research. How would you feel, or what do you think personally about a meeting where a group of doctors and scientists would discuss your case, period? Like, how do you feel about that concept or that meeting?
Are you joking?
Goodness.
Nope.
You mean like a
review? You want a group of doctors and scientists to get together to discuss my case?
I dream big,
forget
sir.
Forget it. You do good if you get a few minutes with a doctor, much less
he
a
said,
scientist.
He said, would you like it?
Oh, well.
Like
the next question is, how much do you want to pay for it?
I think anytime you get a group of any higher knowledge people together to discuss your diagnosis, you're going to benefit in the long run. Because they're going to be brainstorming possible new treatments, and anytime we can get new treatments out there, the better we're going to be.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the difference between a teaching facility and your everyday general practice doctor.
Yeah.
Even if he's, you know, specializing in hematology, if he's in a office setting versus a clinical or teaching, you know, that's why, you know, Shan's a little bit different than,
mm-hmm.
you know,
than other facilities.
Quackery.
Yeah, I would like to see that, something like that, like an annual review that way, you know, once a year.
Okay.
Be able to
like
sit
a
down.
Progress report.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I guess alongside the next question, or any other comments or any other thoughts about such a meeting? Well, my next question about that is, like, how would you personally feel about attending that meeting? Would you like to be there for that discussion?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yes is all around.
Yes,
good. Is there anyone in particular you'd like to take with you at that meeting? Like, can you think of a... I see people reaching and looking over to their partners. Well, hopefully your doctor would be at that meeting.
Well, I don't know. He's in Fort Myers and we're here, so.
So distance, so that's another disparity. Okay.
So in a meeting like that, would you feel comfortable, let's say, having your doctor pinned by webinar or Skype or a technology like that?
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, has it?
My doctor I have right now, I would feel comfortable, but... He's closing his clinic as of April, so now I have to look for another doctor, so now that's the other problem. Mm. So, yes, I would like to have any doctors that would be available to go, you know, from Fort Myers to discuss my treatments
mm-hmm.
rather
mm-hmm.
than me having to do all the research.
Okay.
The spouse? I'd like to have my spouse in that meeting. And doctors and no lawyers.
Yeah, no lawyers.
Go ahead, ma'am.
I hadn't thought about this till you just brought it up, but I'm sure a lot of us in this room see other physicians, and I mean primary care, but maybe others too. And now that I think about it, there's very often something relates to the MDS that comes up as part of your other care. And mm-hmm. the point is they may suggest something that you know that shouldn't happen because you know something else about, you know. And a lot of other doctors are not real knowledgeable. They're beginning to know MDS, I'm finding. I also mm-hmm. have PNH, and boy, you can say that word out there, and very few people know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And so then if they start suggesting something, you know, anyway, where I'm going with that is, it might be interesting, whether it's by Skype or otherwise, to have the folks, you know, that you're seeing for other purposes
okay.
involved in that. I know Dr. Koval had told me 10 years ago to be real careful from now on with limiting my sunshine and burning, just all that kind of thing. And I started seeing a dermatologist. And to her credit, she immediately went and researched this herself and found out that long-term use of cyclosporine can, because of the suppression aspects of that, can cause skin cancer to a much greater degree than otherwise. Okay. But, you know, if I hadn't said something, or if she hadn't taken it on her own to do that, that's just an example of stuff that just happens out there, you know?
Yeah.
It would be nice if they could all kind of get a feeling for what it relate, how it relates to what they're treating you for, you know? Mm-hmm.
So what I'm hearing is basically kind of like an intranet or doctors being educated on, right, about other things that are going on
if
with you.
If it can't be done specifically to the patient, maybe there still needs to be just more education of other doctors about our group's
illnesses and how it connects, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It seems like that for that meeting would have to be sort of like a primary care network. Your primary care network needs to be in attendance. It needs to be a little bit more crosstalk for everyone involved to learn more about all the other different aspects of everything else. Anyone else you could think of to attend such a meeting? I like the idea of having more than just the physician you think about, like having your entire network of physicians. Sounds like a very smart idea. Anyone else? Any other suggestions? So next I want to ask, which questions in regards to MDS do you think researchers need to focus on? You heard about a couple clinical trials that are being conducted or being applied for grants. Are there any questions that you would like to have answered or any trials that you would like to see researchers conduct? Yes, sir?
I was keeping up with clinical trials through Dr. List, and I received a phone call from the MDS Foundation that the drug Ryan Overload was up for approval. What I'm recommending to you, if any of you ever get in that situation, do what I did. I said, I'll be on the next airplane because I want to talk to the panel of doctors that sort of approved or disapproved the drug. And so there were 15 of us that actually got up and spoke to this panel.
Okay.
And so I highly recommend that. Because I feel like that made a difference. And the doctor just sitting there and nobody, explaining what their condition is and why you should approve or not approve the drug.
That's
okay. So being at the front table when these medicines are being approved is pretty much what he's saying. And to be having your voice heard there. Okay. Anybody else?
Is there work being done on a cure or just a treat?
There's only one cure.
So I guess that's a question.
We do attend. A lot of the research is geared towards the cure.
Okay.
But it's helpful to hear that from you because there's, when you only have a certain amount of money and a certain amount of time, do you focus on reducing transfusions initially, or do you go for a cure which can actually make transfusions worse? So as a physician and researcher, you have to make choices, and it's helpful to hear from you as the patients about where the priorities are. Hearing that you want a cure is helpful to us to adjust our parties.
Awesome. I think you had something to say here. And then we'll get back there.
Yes, and the point Dr. Kogel just made about priorities comes into what I'm going to say. And maybe I'm the only one that feels this way, and this would not be what I would suggest to the top priority, obviously. But it's still of great interest to me why, where it came from. I've heard what we know at the time. I had something happen just a few months ago that has caused me to wonder if they are indeed finding some other things that might be underlying MDS, and that has not been proven or whatever yet. And as I say, that's not a top priority thing. Obviously, curing and helping our illness is. But for me personally, it's just one of those things. Why? I mean, so many illnesses, you know where they come from. And we don't really know what where this came from.
So the origin, where it comes from.
Peggy's MDS is secondary. It's because of years of other treatment with chemo and radiation. So it'd be interesting to see if there's any research to determine what drugs are more likely to cause it. And then is there any way to build, can't believe I'm about to say this, another drug to help prevent that? Or some way to figure out how to stop secondary MDS from occurring.
Right. That's a great question. Anybody else on that?
A lot of researchers, from personal experience, this is why we sort of asked this question, partly why the Citizen Scientist Program was even developed in the first place. A lot of researchers that I worked with in the past, like Dr. Kogel was saying, they have a limited amount of funding, and they do research that they feel is important to the community. A lot of times it was done prior, before even talking to the community about it. So part of the reason why the Citizen Scientist Program was developed was that so we can actually talk to the community and see what research questions, like what matters to them, so we can better design research to answer their questions. That's what the intent was in the first place. So that's why I really hope you take the time to think about the answers to this question, like what research questions matter to you, so that we can hopefully get things geared and answer questions that actually are pertinent to you and your situation. Any other research ideas from you guys or any other topics that would matter to you? Research questions you want to see answered? So along those lines, what life outcomes are most important to you? So what they mean by that are like things such as survival time, disease relapse, quality of life, and anything else we didn't mention. Which of these outcomes are the most important to you?
Survival.
Survival time?
Survival.
Survival and quality.
Survival and quality of life?
Yeah, both.
Both?
Yeah.
All around survival and quality of life?
Yeah.
Quality of life.
And what exactly does quality of life mean to you?
As close to free MDS as possible.
Not being stuck on a machine or hooked up to machines, yeah. Or being able to get out and go walking, or being able to fly if you want to travel, or okay. Me, that's called the
life. Okay.
So freedom from machines, not being hooked up, being able to move around of your own accord,
yeah,
being able,
wanna,
like you said, to...
I don't want to be affected like a lot of patients who have cancer in the end are hooked up to machines, and it's not a good quality of life. I don't want that. I want to be able to function on my own, have independence.
Yeah. Having independence. Yeah. Any other takers? What does quality of life mean to you?
Not being so tired all the time that yeah. You're able to do what you want to do.
Right. Yeah. As close to normal as you can get.
Okay. Well, you know, the next question I have to ask is, how do you define normal?
To do the things that were normal for you
yeah.
Before.
Normal function.
Yeah. To sort of continue with the hobbies that you had before.
Yeah.
I understand. Any yeah. other takers?
Last question?
Oh.
How about in defining quality, how about being able to work again?
Yeah.
Wow, I'm going to go that far.
Yeah.
But having a choice would be nice.
Yeah.
Don't spend any money on that.
I think everyone wants to just scratch that question.
Wrong age group.
but it is important to get these accurate description of how you feel quality of life, what that term is, because for different people it means a variety of different things, even just from the answers you heard here. So thank you for answering that. Anyone?
One other thing. I'm sorry. Okay.
You, sir?
I was going to say, today, several things that remind me of quality of life. The one thing that really sticks out in my head is the children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren that we have, to be able to spend that time with them. Mm-hmm. It's frustrating to be able to go out there and play baseball or kick a soccer ball around. You do those things anymore. Now, I try to keep the positive attitude going so the child doesn't pick that up. But it is something to think about.
Enjoying the...
Right. And you had something to say?
Yeah, one other
David?
Thing to define quality of life, I would say, is not being dependent on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I hate taking drugs.
Heard.
Attest to that. I just despise it. I mean, I'll live with something, a headache or something, before I take Tylenol or before I take anything for a headache. I just despise it, and that's just a personal problem with me.
Right.
But I think, for me, a good quality of life would be, like somebody down there said, not being tired and not being dependent on machines or drugs.
Okay. Dependency. Anybody else?
And one of the last major questions we had then, what can researchers now and future researchers do to make you want to, I guess, better participate in clinical trials? Like, is there anything in particular that we could do shaping research in the future to help or convince more people to join in these clinical trials?
Get more feedback to the person that's participating in the trial.
Perfect.
So if I'm going to participate in the trial, I may sound selfish, but I want something out of it too. I want to know what my input, how it's, like if I'm committing bone marrow or something, I want to know how my bone marrow looked. So I think, getting more feedback to the individual participants of the clinical trial would encourage me more.
Right.
Personally.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You're on. And you did you have something to say? You? No? Okay.
No, I was agreeing with him.
Okay, heard.
We're about to start a trial. We're just one of the, and I don't know how you get around this, but one of the items is that you don't know whether you're getting the real drug or not. So we're going through all this testing and everything, and she may be getting a placebo or something.
So if you're
getting the actual drug that they're testing rather than some saline or whatever.
Okay.
I do know that for a lot of trials, they do try to increase the ratio of people who are actually getting the real treatment, if that's any consolation. You probably won't know which one you're getting, but they do try to tip the odds in your favor, if that helps.
That defeats the clinical trial double-blind aspect of the clinical trial.
Well, and that's what's...
I agree with you, but it defeats a key point in the clinical trial.
Exactly.
It's not double-blind anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as soon as anyone knows who's getting what, you kind of lose a little bit of validation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But so how do they go about picking the person to put on the real trial or not? That's the question.
That depends on the trial.
Yeah.
More often than not, it's randomized. So no one has
That's the thing that scares me about being on a trial is...
Okay.
What is the guidelines of saying this person gets the treatment and actually I feel like they're playing God?
Okay.
Who's the person who's going to benefit more from the treatment, and am I going to say you're not going to benefit, so you don't get to be part of the treatment. You get to be part of the placebo group, and that's the one thing that scares me about being in a clinical trial.
Okay.
Is who holds that over my head, and who controls whether or not I live possibly longer or not?
Mm-hmm. If it's random, then
nobody.
One person. It's just...
I know, but it's still scary.
But if you let a doctor decide that we're going to give the real medicine to the people that are more likely to respond,
then you've defeated the purpose of the trial, because it's not a trial anymore. It's a, you know, it's a biased trial.
I know. But it's still scary.
Yeah, oh, God, man, I would never argue that fact. It's the whole MDS.
It's like the people who shoot, there's one person who has the bullet, and then there's four other who don't have the bullet, so that they don't know if they actually killed the person or not. So,
would the trial aspect being that it's completely random who gets what, and even if they tip the odds in your favor, let's say 60-40% or 70-30%, does that make you feel a little less nervous? Still the same amount of anxiety?
No, because I would.
I don't know that there's a way to change that.
Yeah.
But the dissemination of the data would be a benefit. Okay.
So, wanting to know how it came about.
Yeah, and not having to wait 5 years to see the data.
Okay.
Maybe that's why they don't do it.
Okay.
The ones that
are not on
their own pill don't see improvement.
Okay.
Can I ask a specific question in relation to this?
Of course.
Some of the physicians and nurses' concern is that there isn't enough time to talk to the patient when you guys come to the clinic. You know, you have a blood, marrow, visit, I mean, it's just infusions, it's left. What we're wondering is, would you be willing to sit with a research nurse, and so when you come to a clinic on your itinerary, would it be okay to have a slot where you have a research nurse visit, and you go over the trial, what are new trials, maybe even a follow-up of the trials that you're on? Would you be okay with having that in your itinerary visit?
Absolutely.
Sure. Anyone not like that? You're hesitant?
No. Oh. How many years ago was it when we went to Moffitt the first time? 5 years ago?
That was not MDS related.
I know. It wasn't MDS related, but we had a research person come in and talk to us and ask me if I'd be interested in a clinical trial. Of course, I'm willing to do whatever it takes and get my hopes up. And then I go in and see the doctor and have that doctor totally deny me the chance of even being on a clinical trial.
Okay. Hmm.
And that's the concern that you have to think about, too.
Okay.
Okay.
So the point was, I don't want someone to come in and then hype up this opportunity and then have the doctor come in and say, sorry, you can't do that. Okay. That's good to know. Sorry that happened to you, but that's horrible. Thank you. Oh.
Just one other suggestion. I would love to see a much more in-depth medical history done early on. More than just the typical medical history. I'm talking about stuff that relates to perhaps parents, other family members, maybe places where people lived, exposure other people had to things. It would just seem to me that for a lot of reasons down the pike, because there's so much that isn't known yet and is going to be tackled in the future, that a lot of that information might just spring something up. If there was a collective amount of it, could be put in the computer, and all of a sudden it shows, well, there's a portion of folks that had such and such happen, or had a parent with this, or whatever. I don't know what it might prove, but
might have some correlation.
I have a social work background, so I'm into histories, yeah. But I just can't help but think that might be helpful for a lot of research perspectives if it was done by a person who really knew how to do that in the beginning and was much more in depth than just, what are your allergies and,
So a comprehensive medical or medical history.
And like part of the social history maybe, not personal stuff.
Like a geographical area type.
More about health of family members, just things that still relate, in some fashion or concern or significance or something.
Right.
Okay. Sorry.
something that, and this is really not clinical by any means, but it's something that just drives me crazy. With technology and electronic medical records, there needs to be some way to pull all that together. I have 9 different logins for electronic medical records, and none of them talk to each other. So just as you're talking about paper versus, you know, the computer way, if everybody has a different electronic medical record system and they don't communicate, that's impeding progress.
This might be a tad bit off topic, I'm sorry, but there's an institute, a PCORI, Patient Centered Outcomes and Research Institute. They're making a push for exactly that, where big data sort of connects with each other, and that's the one of the projects I'm working on. It's called the One Florida CDRN, or One Florida Clinical Research Network. They're actually looking to work with doctors across Florida to sort of link all the medical records. Cool. So patient one, if he was seen at a clinic in like Daytona, and then another clinic in Miami, and another one in Orlando, they would be able to link those records through each site. So that kind of addresses what you're talking about, and that's there is a push for that. Good. So hopefully that helps.
And that
you.
Helps with over medication.
It will help with a lot of things. So for
you
sure.
Might find some pushback from that from the privacy aspect people, because you know if one doctor's got access to my Chan's information, that's fine. But if he's got access to all my information, some people, I don't object because I don't care what if anybody knows what's wrong with me. But some people might object to that. And another factor, as my wife just mentioned, you know, if you put all that data into one database, everything that man can hack. So
I'd rather be in one than nine.
There.
I'd rather be in one place than nine places.
If it gets hacked, you know, it's out there.
If somebody's going to hack programs, yeah. what do they most likely hack? Microsoft or Windows,
yeah.
Because it's the most predominant program out there. If somebody's going to hack a medical record facility, if all the medical records are in, you know, San Antonio, what organization do you think they're going to concentrate on? And then you're going to have all the hackers concentrating on that one database.
Mm-hmm.
And
the
chances of one person getting into the database is, you know, X percent. The chances of thousands of these idiots out there hacking from the, you know, bedroom, hacking into this database.
That used to keep me awake at night, and then I finally realized it's going to happen.
It is. But
so just live with it. It's going to happen.
Just because it's going to happen doesn't necessarily make it.
Have to make it easy.
Don't make it easier.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
And
there has to be safeguards.
Well, then I guess, like, because since this is actually my area, I can probably I can talk your ears off about that. But just to set your minds at ease a little bit, in this database there are no identifying records of, like, no identifying names. There is a very, very complicated algorithm used to sort of hash any patient identifying number. It's called SHA-256, and I think there's like over 9 quintillion.
So it's like a blockchain.
It's a very complicated algorithm. It's almost hack proof, but like, you know, there's always issues around. But anyway, it seems like, are we running out of time?
Yes, we are.
Oh wow, I'm sorry. I will stop talking about that.
So if everyone please give me a round of applause for Dana.
Thank you, guys.
This is fantastic. All this information is going to be used for designing our studies and also changing our system. And we're also going to be asking the MDS Foundation to disseminate this information to other MDS centers. And if when we need the transcript, there will be no identifying information on the transcript, but if this has gone well, we'll also talk to them about posting these kinds of focus groups and other symposia as well to help other places. So let's take a 10-minute break, come back at 2 o'clock. Christina Klein will be talking about quality of life. Thank you.